Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for downloading the podcast this week. I'm John Montgomery. Our subject today revolves along a discussion of compositing in linear light with MasterZap. You may recognize MasterZap as a related to 3D technologies and working for mental images. He's really got a cool blog, which we'll give you a link at the end of the podcast too. But he's the author of a lot of mental ray shader libraries and so forth, and just really, really good technical resource for us. Now, those of you who have, you know, worked in feature films probably are well familiar with compositing in linear light or compositing in linear space. Maybe those working on broadcast projects as well as, you know, commercials and so forth think that you're compositing in linear, but in fact you're ending up working with gamma encoded 2:2 stuff for video. And these guys talk about this in the podcast, but it's interesting because thankfully I was kind of pointed out about the joys of compositing in linear light working in After Effects years ago. Stu Mashwitz helped develop the Elin plugin years ago, and these guys actually talk about that as well in the podcast. And I think After Effects is great because linear light workflow actually got introduced into After Effects. So the idea that you actually convert all your imagery into linear space, true linear space, work on it where things mathematically blend correctly and so forth, and then convert it on the way out into the space where you need your final destination files to be. And during that process, actually use display color management to actually be able to view your colors correctly. That's a really confusing subject for those not used to working this way, and that's why I think actually After Effects is a fantastic resource for doing that. It's a really affordable application. It actually does a lot of things that correctly when working, and actually can kind of teach you to work in a way that makes sense when you're compositing in linear light space. So without me jabbering on anymore, why don't we go ahead and join this discussion? It's really a good one. They'll walk us through a lot of cool, interesting techniques as well as information regarding linear light versus gamma 2:2 space. So let's join that conversation now. Mike Seymour speaking with MasterZap.
Zap, thank you for joining us. Really appreciate it.
No problem.
So I wanted to have a discussion with you, a fairly technical discussion about the idea of linear workflows. And I guess the two things that are motivating me to discuss this at this time is two things. Firstly, just in the last week or so, Apple decided to move to a gamma of 2.2, which I think was an interesting thing for it to do because that had previously been slightly incongruous between PC and Macs. But the second thing is that this whole area of linear and the concept of linear is something that's been opened to a lot of people that maybe weren't previously aware of it because the Red camera has a linear sensor, and because it outputs the raw data, it's actually possible to look at raw pictures in a way that really we didn't actually do much before, even though they always existed. It was always that we got our images downstream of some video conversion. And I'm wondering, have you found a sort of a renewed interest or a growing interest in this whole area of whether it is possible to actually set up a linear pipeline for post-production?
Yes, that's the feelings I've been getting lately, because I've been fighting a long time for people working in a linear workflow in the context of rendering in computer graphics, because it's really a sad state of affairs when most softwares you buy out of the box and you turn them on are set basically with the gamma correction turned completely off, and you're basically rendering incorrectly to the screen. Basically, light values are just applied to pixel values with no transformation in between, and it just doesn't work that way because the screen has a gamma and it's a nonlinear device. This is a thing I've been kicking and screaming about for years from my end. And then we always channel Stu on these podcasts. We have Stu Mashwitz, you know, screaming from his end of the field about compositing should be done in a linear space. And we've all been screaming about this. And now I hear it coming also from the, you know, cinematography side of things, when you suddenly stop seeing, you know, like video images, which is what we kind of been working with before in the past, and now we start to see actual data coming in, which we treat more like data than just basically a picture. So I really feel...
Let me run a couple of assumptions by you and tell me, I think most of them you might flag as being wrong, but they're things that most people, I think many people anyway, would believe to be, you know, pretty reasonable approach to this. And in a short, just give me a quick rebuttal, because I've got about six of these I'd like to throw at you. The first one is, surely if there's sort of a good color picture coming into my system and a good color picture going out, I'm good to go, right?
You're not. That's the thing. And that's the basically probably the most basic thing that most people are thinking, and it's probably the root cause of this, because you're getting images in a traditional workflow. You're getting images from, say, your DV camera, or maybe JPEGs from your in your still camera, and you get this image in and you look at it and the image looks nice, and then you apply some form of transformation. You want to do some math on this image, and you do this math on these pixel values, which you don't really know what they are, but I mean they look pretty, so they are pictures, and you apply math to them, and then you get some image out and you say this has to be correct because the image looked correct the entire time. But the problem is that you have a display, a computer display, which is a nonlinear device. And the second problem is that the guys who built the video camera and the guys who built your stills camera, they knew this, so they already baked this information into the image. So the image you're getting is nonlinear. And when this nonlinear image ends up in your program and you start to do math on these nonlinear pixels, the math will be broken. It will not work. And you will get into all sorts of incorrect results when you do anything but the most trivial thing to the image.
Okay, well, before we get into the details of that, let me run a couple of others by you. If I've got a calibrated monitor, I'm good to go, right? Because I've got a calibrated monitor.
It's exactly wrong, precisely, because most people also think that, I don't need to care about this. You know, gamma correction is to correct some defect in my monitor because it's broken somehow. So I buy this calibration tool, and then the universe is shiny, and I can never care about this. That is exactly the wrong thing.
Because that was going to be my next point, actually, that this whole gamma thing is just because of an error that happened in CRT displays.
Yeah, exactly. That is also precisely the wrong thing. Because what happens if you have a calibrated monitor, you do have it calibrated to a standard gamma, which is generally the sRGB gamma of 2.2. And the 2.2, the gamma of a CRT monitor was never really an error per se. It was a side effect of what CRT displays, what the electron gun of a cathode ray tube actually does. But it's not a bug. It's actually a feature, because the human eye is a funny and wondrous thing, and the human eye doesn't actually see light intensities in a linear way. We perceive, take a very, very tiny change of light intensity at a very low level. This can appear as big to us as a very large intensity change when we have a high intensity. So basically going from, 1 lux of illumination to 2 lux might look like a big step, when going from 100 to 150 might look like an equivalent step to the eye. This was numbers I pull out of the air, though, so they might be wrong. But the principle is that when you're up at the higher numbers of absolute light values, the eye perceives this as actually being smaller steps. And it so happens that when you have a nonlinear encoding of the image, this actually becomes more efficient. You're using the bits better, because the pixel value of 0 and 1 is actually a very tiny light intensity change compared to the light intensity change going from 254 to 255 in the byte in your video memory. And this is actually very efficient because it matches the way the human eye perceives color, but it's not linear. When you go from the value 0 to 255, the bytes in your video memory on your computer screen, when you get to the halfway value, which is around 127, you're absolutely not at half the intensity. You're actually only at about 20% the intensity. And if you're calculating on these raw byte values, which tons and tons of software does, if you think that adding this 127 halfway value in the pixel color space, adding two of these together and getting the full intensity, basically adding 50% of the pixel value and adding 50% of another pixel value and get 100%, well, these 50%, the 127, the halfway level, is actually not half intensity. So you're really adding 20%. Actually, if you measure the intensity of the half pixel value on screen, it's only about 20%. So you're basically adding 2 plus 2 and getting 10. And I mean, when I went to school, the teacher slapped you on the fingers if you thought that 2 plus 2 is 10.
Well, let me just describe that for somebody who's just trying to imagine what it is that would look like, because obviously we're doing this in audio. But if we had any kind of generic object in 3D, and let's pick a teapot because we like teapots. If you had two pools of light that were overlapping, that were hitting that object, if both of them were at 127 on an 8-bit scale, then if you used maths that ignored this gamma stuff, you'd say, well, 127 overlaps with 127, so 2 127s is going to equal 254. In other words, double 127, you get pretty much full-on bright 100%.
Exactly.
So your two 20%s there would add to 100. I shouldn't say yours, because your argument would be that, in fact, what I was doing was adding about 20% light with 20% light, and I should have ended up with 40% light. So that overlapping pool of light that's hitting our teapot won't be 100% bright white. It'll actually be about 40% or 175 in the kind of scheme of things.
Exactly.
And so that's going to actually mean I get less realistic... Yeah, I'm going to get actually less realistic results in my 3D render if I just comp it incorrectly.
Exactly. If you comp it in we have this issue also because, you know, log files has been with us a long time. And then when you convert this to a video, they used to call this linear, as I know you mentioned this before, which isn't really linear. Stu Meshwitz, which we're channeling again here, as we always do, had the term for this and called this video color space. Basically, when you are in the video color space, which is kind of this colors, the sRGB color space of your computer monitor, this is nonlinear. So when you have the 127 pixel value and you want to add these light intensities together, you do not get to 250. You cannot do the math really on these bytes. That's the whole point. It's wrong to do the math on the bytes. You have to basically take the byte value, convert it to what is the actual intensity of this byte, do the math on the actual intensity, and then convert the actual intensity back to a new byte, which is the proper thing to put in the pixel.
So let me just keep painting some pictures of how this is going to go wrong for somebody, because I think you need to know where it's going wrong to realize why you want it to go right. So we've just said that if you get two flashlights in a digital 3D imaginary environment that are 20% each, you obviously want them to overlap and not be 100% white, because common sense would tell you that two 20% torches or lights or spotlights in 3D shouldn't max out. And of course, if you ignore the maths, they will. Exactly. But similarly, we can get unrealistic fall off on things. We can also get sort of blowouts happening where the highlights are just too strong, or even artifacts around highlights. And I wanted that last one to talk to you about that, because in fact, I think it comes as a surprise to some people that there's actually stuff happening in some of the software applications to deliberately mask this artifact that would happen around the highlights, because they've literally sort of built in a correction to the fact that they weren't bothering to sort out the maths right in the first place. Is that correct?
Yes, that is unfortunately correct. So the artifact around the highlight comes because of the fact that basically, you have a diffuse shading and you have a specular highlight and you want to add. And if you just add these together and you're doing it in the wrong color space, you, by running into this 2 plus 2 is 10 math, it basically blows out too quickly. This is a thing you basically can recognize if you've done, you know, compositing in any old traditional compositing application using just video and trying to use add. I mean, anytime you try to use the add in like After Effects when you're running it in a traditional old school 8-bit, I'm just put in my DV camera and I want to add something, it looks weird and it blows out immediately. And the reason it looks weird and blows out immediately is this 2 plus 2 is 10 problem. And you really get this kind of thing, you know, with the highlights, the specular highlight on like your shiny teapot. Especially if you have a colored teapot and a white highlight, you also run into the issue that one of the components, if say there is a red red teapot and you put a highlight on it, the red color which actually be pushed up too high and clip immediately. And when the red component clips, it becomes a discontinuity. And there's another thing, you know, funny with the human eyes, that we don't really see absolute intensities as much as we see the change in intensity. We actually look.
Yeah,
and also the change in the speed of the change, the second derivative. We are edge detection machines, basically. That's how our visual sense works. So this clipping looks almost like a circle. It becomes a very nasty artifact to the human eye, even though it's probably basically normal that this this clipping is occurring, but the clipping looks really bad. So many software saw this. They didn't realize they were working in the wrong gamma. Say, oh, what do we do with that? And they were scratching their heads, and they throw in horrendous hacks, like basically subtracting the specular from the diffuse before adding it back again, and crazy stuff like this, just to avoid these blowouts. Or there's another classical thing I heard so many times. People say, yeah, well, you can't get a good image out of the renderer, so I render the diffuse pass separately with the specular pass, and then I put them into my compositing app and I screen them together. And the screen compositing application in a compositing program is such a horrendous hack, basically to avoid blowouts. Screen is kind of like an ad that never ever goes over one. The real math for screen is basically one minus the sum of one minus each of the components, which basically ends up, it's kind of like the ad that never sums above one. It's the magical ad. But, and this looks nice, but mathematically it's complete insanity to do this. So anytime you see somebody using the screen composite to do basically anything, that's when you should hold your head and run around and scream and say no, because what they are trying to do is to work around the deficiency in the ad, and the reason they're trying to working around any deficiency in the ad is because they're doing the ad in the wrong color space. If you do the ad in the correct color space, then everything looks nice and shiny. You still can get even with doing the correct ad, the fact that one of the components will be clipping, it will still be clipping first. If you have something which is only red and you start to add another color, obviously the red component will hit the ceiling faster than the other components because it already had a bigger value when you started out. But since it's coming in basically in a different angle of intensity, not slamming hard into the ceiling, it's kind of coming in more horizontally towards this hitting the ceiling, it looks better. Plus, in the ideal world, you would have a tone mapper, some form of tone mapping at the end of this, which will actually handle compression of highlights, so you would never actually clip. But this is something that the tone mapper should apply at the end to apply a look to the image. The image is even more nonlinear because there tends to be this look baked into it. Like if you take your average digital camera, your average video camera, it's not only the fact that it has a gamma on it, it has some kind of tweaks to look a little bit more like film. You know, film has what's called a toe region and a shoulder region in its response curve, where the toe region is basically where stuff gets lost, where it gets underexposed, and the shoulder region is where it starts to, the film cannot respond anymore to light, so it starts to respond less and less, and you basically get a compression of all the high intensities. Now, most cameras think that, people think this look pretty. We were looking at film for many, many years, so they build this into the camera, so it does stuff like this to your image. So, and this is the thing where I like cameras like the Red camera and this more modern workflow, because the Red camera is giving you real, basically linear values and looks and stuff. That is things you apply at the end of your workflow, instead of getting something with the look falling in at the beginning of your workflow and trying to adjust to that. The look is something that you get at the end.
Yeah, no, I must admit, just backing up at 1 second, that's exactly how I came across this back in the day. The film guys were doing really clever things with splitting out their renders into passes and doing maths on them, because unbeknownst to me at the time as a junior compositor, they were sort of applying lookups in terms of the monitor lookup, but of course the maths was remaining very pure underneath. And in being a budding compositor, I wanted to do that too. So I got some stuff rendered in video and then tried doing a multi-pass render combine and couldn't work out why none of my things would go together correctly. And in fact, we've only hit on a few of the problems of not doing this properly. For example, you get unrealistically strong reflections, for example, if you're doing 3D compositing from doing this. Exactly. You can get really sort of weird propagations of the indirect light, all sorts of things that can go wrong. And if you were really to analyze it, sort of strictly speaking, and I'm going to quote now from something that you actually yourself wrote a little while ago, everything from text rendering right through to just about all of the aspects of motion blur, focus blur, layering, multiplying, simulating fog, simulating light, double exposure, a lot of these things will all work much, much better if one has a linear workflow. And I think we've established now that we have a problem. Houston, we have a problem. I think the thing that people are really interested in, though, is not only is there a problem, but how the heck do I go about working in an environment that doesn't throw up this problem? And so we need to work our way towards how they do that. And the first thing I wanted to start with is just clarifying what's going on with some of the file formats. So before we get into a more in-depth discussion of how I solve this problem, tell me, in terms of file formats, what's the status? JPEGs and EXRs and stuff. I mean, is it as simple as one has it baked in and one doesn't?
If it only were that simple, that would be nice. It's almost, in most cases, it is kind of almost that simple. It's, if we say a JPEG, you could almost say that every time the JPEG has the gamma baked in. I mean, the JPEG generally comes from your you know, digital camera. And if it comes straight out of your digital camera and you didn't do anything particularly complicated to your camera, you will get it in the sRGB color space or Adobe RGB or whichever. It doesn't matter which one of these you use, because in both cases the gamma is 2.2, so you have a gamma baked in. And for the EXRs, in an ideal world, they would all be linear, because that was kind of the whole point of Pixar defining the format for the EXRs. But unfortunately, we do not live in the ideal world, so you can never be completely sure. I've seen my share of EXRs with a gamma baked in, and I've seen my share of JPEGs that were basically supposed to be interpreted linearly because somebody really computed them or whatever. Then we have the further complication of file format, which actually contains information about the gamma in them, like PNG format, for instance. It has a field in the header which says this file has a gamma of this and this. Unfortunately, this sometimes is wrong. Or even if this value is actually correct, software sometimes interprets it incorrectly. And I think a famous case, unless this has changed in recent years, this is the famous case of Windows' own image viewer, the one basically built into Windows. If there is a gamma in the header of a PNG file, it will actually display it applying this as a gamma correction, whereas the proper way would be to apply a correction of the difference between this gamma and the actual gamma of your display. So if your display has 2.2 and the file is encoded with 2.2 and it says 2.2 in the header, well, then it should simply display the file, whereas the Windows file viewer sees, oh, there's a gamma 2.2 in the header, and actually applies a gamma correction of 2.2, making the image look totally blown out and crazy. So life isn't as beautiful as it should be, unfortunately, but in most cases your EXRs are linear, and in most cases your JPEGs has it baked in. And for other formats, it's, you know, depending on the face of the moon and the stuff like that. So
well, give me some good news then. Is it possible, if I'm a struggling compositor type person who's working in a non-film environment, so I'm by necessity I have to deal with some kind of video work color space stuff, is it possible that I can work in a linear fashion with Photoshop or After Effects, or am I just completely gone until someone comes out with a new app?
No, you can, and that's the great thing. And we, again, have to thank Stu a little for that, for kicking and screaming a couple of years ago, and even his guys writing the Elin plugin for After Effects, basically showing Adobe, like, this is the way you do it. So these days, you can do this. I'm not so super familiar with the linear features in Photoshop, because I don't use Photoshop so much. I think there's actually a fairly nice little checkbox somewhere in the setup where you say, apply math in a linear space, and you basically check this box, and it more or less works. In After Effects, I know a little bit about the color management stuff. There you can say that your workspace should be in a linear color space, because that is really the thing. This is another tricky topic, you know, when you get into the topic of color management and you start to use color management tools. Most of the color management tools, their job is to transfer stuff from A to B and make it work, scanned on scanner A, printed on printer B, and make this work. They deal basically with the transformation from something to something else, and it's not really so much, but I want to get the real stuff in the middle. I'm basically, I want this coming from A, I want this converted to actual, you know, some form of canonical real world values. And that's not really what most color management tools in general are about. They are really about going from A to B, not going from A to the perfect, and then from the perfect to B. I want the perfect. I want basically, in an ideal world, pixel values would be, you know, candela per square meter measurements, calibrated photometrically or something like that. And unfortunately, we don't really get that. But in After Effects, you do have the ability to set up a workspace, a project, so your working color space is linear, and make sure you work in more than 8 bits than internally, etc. So you can do these things. You can do this in the last years. If you go back like 4 years ago, you would have to do it basically manually with a bunch of your own little gamma conversions back and forth. But it's getting built in there these days. So
we've talked about the RED camera is going to be able to actually film some stuff linear. What about 3D programs in terms of generating them? You obviously are heavily involved in the 3D world. So where is the 3D world at? Is it comfortable with this, or is it still expecting to have workarounds?
Well, this depends a lot on which softwares you use. Some software has more, some has less features for handling this. This issue. And I think in every software you can render something, because I mean by default when you render something and you do nothing, you're doing a linear rendering. I mean the math inside the renderer is basically correct. The problem is that if you don't do anything, this correct image that you have computed inside the machine gets basically put on your computer screen without anything being done to it. And since the computer screen was a nonlinear device, you're actually looking at this quote-unquote correct image, but you're looking at it in the wrong way. You're seeing the wrong thing. And the second problem is if you're putting textures into your 3D software. You have taken, you know, a photograph of some wood with your camera, and you use this as a wood texture in your rendering. The problem now, your camera made a non-linear image. It goes in as a texture. So basically, while the math in the middle of your rendering software is correct, it's actually getting fed the wrong thing. It's getting fed a non-linear texture. And now comes the really tricky part. You're getting this non-linear texture in, and you're doing the right math on it, and then you're displaying it again in the incorrect way, which makes it appear, and this is the really scary part, it makes it appear as this nonlinear texture which you put in actually looks correct. I mean, the color tones of this texture will be correct because it was nonlinear going in and you're displaying it back on a nonlinear device. But the math in the middle is what gets massacred because although the math was right, you're displaying it wrong. It just is basically luck that your texture coming in was wrong in exactly the same way, but you're still broken the math. So what needs to happen is that textures which are nonlinear, like JPEGs, they somehow has to be made linear going in. And you can either do that if the software has a feature for gamma correction, basically turn it on and tell it to do that. Otherwise, there are generally are conversion shaders you can put in the middle, say, convert this, apply, you know, a gamma correction of this and this to this texture. Or, I mean, you can basically batch convert your textures to linear EXRs, but then they tend to take up more memory for not so much benefit. So it's general probably the better to load in the JPEG and let the software or your shader take care of the conversion going in. And then comes the problem of going out. How do you view the image correctly? Well, there's a couple of options. Again, if the software has a feature for displaying with the proper gamma correction, well, you're done and fine. If not, then you can either apply a shader at the end to view it correctly, but that can be a little bit dangerous because then you're really baking in your final pixels. You're again baking in a gamma, and you might not want that. You might want that for view, but you know, if you want to save it linear, you're kind of in trouble. So another way is basically to ignore the pixels displayed on screen of your 3D software and just think of this coming out as data, save it to an EXR and whatever, and view it in some other program which are able to view this in the correct way.
In fact,
basically bypassing the display feature of your software.
In fact, the analogy that we've kind of learned from the RED camera holds up pretty well, doesn't it? It's this idea that the underlying data you want to not bake stuff in, and you want to have some metadata that goes along, and then you can view that underlying data at a yes. button change or whatever you want. And that's actually not a bad way to think of it. The Red camera is not trying to be an educational tool in this respect, but it actually doesn't work as a bad kind of way to think about it. I think where a lot of people get confused is this whole idea of display gammas and stuff versus baked-in gammas, and they seem to be like, you know, there's a gamma on the monitor, and also you sort of feel like you can't look at anything. And yet if you swing your head around to thinking about it in the Red world for a second, well, I can obviously open up a Red file in Red Alert and just look at the raw file, and it doesn't break the universe to look at a raw file, and it does look dark, but I can see exactly what I'm doing. I also just want to pick up on one other point you made earlier about Photoshop, just because I do come from a compositing background. If you are in the new CS4, you just need to go into your preferences, and there's a GPU settings there for your presumably like NVIDIA card or whatever, and there's an advanced settings button. You just simply press on that, and then in a slightly obtuse point of the program, it actually says debugging compositing, gamma corrected, linear or none, and that will actually change what the, for want of a better term, the checkerboard transparency mode is used when it's compositing. That'll be the thing that determines how it decides to composite layers inside Photoshop, whether or not it assumes linear or gamma corrected. And so it isn't like the hardest thing in the world, but it is a pretty complicated thing to get your head around, because quite often, unless you can separate the concept of the underlying data with something as a sort of a display adjuster, you're worried that you're feeding in dark images and that it doesn't look right, which gets back to this earlier point we said of, if it looks good going in and it looks good coming out, I must be all right. So it really is a matter of getting like a pipeline set up, isn't it, Zap? We really need to get an overall pipeline that's consistent, because once it's all consistent, as it is when you've got a Red workflow pulling in stuff, it all actually becomes relatively easy. It's only when you're sort of mixing and matching that it becomes dangerous.
Yeah, and I mean, in an ideal world, like I said, you would be getting straight off your camera. You would be getting, you know, EXR files one per frame, which are, you know, calibrated to candela per square meter measurements. So you don't even worry about exposure until some later day. I don't know if most cameras are not really there yet because the sensors... I don't have the dynamic range for that. But I mean, in theory, the concept of something being white is an arbitrary decision, right? That your white point is something, basically you're deciding at some point that this amount of actual light in the real world should represent my white.
Oh, yeah. And also, for anyone that's ever white balanced the camera, the color white is not as simple as it seems.
Sure, but let's ignore the chromaticity of white for a moment and just think about the intensity. So, I mean, this is an arbitrary decision. So in a purely, you know, theoretical world, your camera is a device which measures luminance values out in the real world, and it gives you these luminance values in a file. And then when you take these luminance values and then you take your renderer and you render luminance values of your CG element and you composite these together and you just use simple, you know, proper additive normal math on it, and then you decide how to view this entire thing by applying some view LUT for both correcting for the gamma of your display, but also applying, you know, the look, the compression of highlights, how you want them, what kind of blackening of the, you know, the toe region you want for it to look nice and pretty and beautiful. This is the thing, you know, for effects facilities, I don't know what is the, you know, state of the art for workflows between effects facilities, because I've seen the hodgepodge of everything. I mean, some people get, you know, the DPX files and some other get some 8-bit TIFFs or 16-bit TIFFs or something, and some has the baked-in look and some not, and then some guy changes the DI and then everything breaks. You worked so hard. I mean, once I worked for a print cover of a magazine, and it was including an explosion, it was some debris in the explosion, and I was working so hard on this image, this debris was almost overshadowed by a glow in this explosion, so I set it just right so you almost saw this debris, and it was a work of art. And then the print guy applied their basically standard make the image pretty curve later, unbeknownst to me, which basically increased the contrast of the image, and it was like, yeah, I normally turn up the contrast like 5% in Photoshop before we print it. Like, you could have told me this. So the image, of course, which came out on the magazine, you couldn't see any of this debris in the explosion. It was completely blown out. So many effects people recognize this. You know, they go to the premiere and sit down and want to see the movie and say, where are my effects and what the hell have you done to them? So this is really something where I think there should be some form of collaboration over the entire pipeline, almost. But the DP, the guy who makes the photographs, he might make the decision that I want this to look, you know, grungy or bleach bypass or whatever, but he shouldn't bake this into the image. Like you said before, it should be basically metadata coming with the pixels. Like, this is kind of how I want you to view this. And then in an ideal world, this data will go to the effects people, and they will work on their effects in a linear space, apply them correctly, and composite them linearly with this data, and then use the view data to say, this is kind of how it will be, you know, on premiere day, and say, okay, my effects works within this kind of view, with this crush or whatever, bleach bypass look or what have you. Unfortunately, you know, some stuff of this is pre-production, the other is production, and some is post-production. And to get all this to talk to back and forth, it almost becomes a relativistic thing with talking back and forth in time, you know, to make this work. So I don't know if there's any production that does this in the reality, but this is certainly a goal that we would like to strive forward to sometime.
Yeah, I'm glad you touched on color there, because I think one of the other sort of aspects that a lot of people find not that I'd believe it, but it's sort of an unusual thing, is that they don't tend to stop and think about the fact that because this is a nonlinear effect we're talking about, we actually have a different response to what's going on between R, G, and B, don't we? So in fact, this isn't even, you know, it's important for maintaining color and to being able to work color spaces correctly to also acknowledge this, because the nonlinear gamma is actually going to affect the relationship between blue, green, and red.
Yes, this is very important. And that is a way you can kind of detect when you're doing it wrong. If your images are coming out washed out and your colors don't look, they look paler and too bright, then this is a symptom of you applying a view gamma when you're not gamma correcting stuff going in. And the reverse stuff is looking way too dark and oversaturated, then there's an indication that you're not applying the view gamma you're basically supposed to do. And in a sense, you can say that this is kind of what we're doing all the time. We're actually sitting viewing our renders, which are oversaturated and too dark, but we're trying to compensate for this viewing by, you know, changing the parameters of the render, throwing more light because, oh, this is too dark in the corner. So I throw in, you know, some bounce light or whatever, some non-physical incorrect lighting there because I want to see stuff. And when you do this, you're using global illumination, then you can get all sorts of strange effects when you try to do non-physical lighting. And you end up in this situation where people are lighting every single thing separately because they have to tweak everything, and they render everything out to a billion layers and sit and composite this night and day in a thousand million ways, because everything has to be tweaked to work. When if they were only doing this in a linear workflow, you can see them render this out and the image is just correct, and you can just slap the beauty shot, you know, with an alpha onto your background plate, and then you're done. You don't need the 100 layers, you don't need to tweak everything, etc., etc., because you're simply rendering the right thing immediately. And yeah, you can even put in physical correct light and everything, and just you just get the right thing out by doing the right thing.
Let me just explain to somebody who I mean, you might accept that listening to this at face value, but just to get it, if you're trying to explain it to a client, I think this is always a really, really great way to understand it. The whole point about a gamma curve, as we all know, it's a bend. We're not lifting every value. If we were lifting every value, it wouldn't be a gamma curve. So the numbers in the middle get moved a lot, and the numbers at white and at black don't move. It's like the bow of an arrow. And so if you think about it for a second, if I was a compositor and you were a 3D guy and you'd produced a lovely image for me that had something that had an RGB component where the red was already at 100%, but green and blue were somewhere in the middle, and we had the wrong gamma adjustment on it. Well, if you think about it for a second, that red value will always remain at 100% in whether it's gamma corrected or not, because gamma doesn't affect 100%. But those middle greens and blues will get shoved up and down quite a lot as the bow of the string gets plucked. And of course, that means that the shade of color that we're dealing with isn't being just lighter or darker. It's actually being skewed to being, you know, like a different color because all three components of RGB aren't being affected in the same way. In other words, they're not being affected the same amount. And if you were to sort of think about doing that arbitrarily to some pictures, you'd be mortified. But that's exactly what you're doing in terms of color values. And I think we need to get back to this point that you so touched on, which is it really needs to be a well-thought-out facility project-level thing, because honestly, it's the textures that can start to trip up 3D as much as getting the maths wrong later on can trip up the 2D people.
Exactly. It's the textures really which is the problem, because in many cases people say, okay, I realize that I need to apply this view gamma to my display to see my render correctly, and then all their textures look washed out and weird and all the colors look strange. They put in some color value and when you hit the render it looks different, because the color swatch they put the color value in was actually not a gamma corrected color swatch. So when they put in this 100% red and 50% green and blue, so they had a 1.5 color, it looked one way to them in the color swatch, but in the render when it was actually gamma corrected, this same color looked different. So in the ideal world, of course, this color swatch where you click to set the color would also be properly gamma corrected when displayed. And this is also unfortunately a situation where between different softwares, this sometimes it works, sometimes it does not. Some do it, some do not. And it's incredibly difficult for someone like me sitting here trying to tell you this is how you do it. Unfortunately, this is how you do it for basically every single program out there. And it's hard as heck to give a single this is how you do it, which works everywhere. And textures, again, it's the same thing with the textures. If you have some image which looked correct when you were just viewing it and you're just throwing this in without fixing up the gamma, linearizing it going in, you again get this, it looks undersaturated and too bright in the render. And that is an indication that you need to fix the gamma of the image going in.
So in summary, just to I guess the good news is the situation is improving, because a number of programs from Photoshop to After Effects to a bunch of other stuff is clearly addressing the problem, though we're far from having a complete solution. I think the second good thing is that even now the camera department guys and the people that are at the front end of digital capture are becoming aware of this for completely different reasons, as we mentioned with the RED camera and this whole move towards shooting data and shooting a linear file and then applying things to it. So the concept now, I think, is less.
Exactly.
I think what you have to do if you're in the trenches, as it were, listening to this, is you have to fight very hard to get your head around and other people's head around the difference between display gammas and baked-in gammas. And the best way to do that, I think, is just to look at the film guys. Because in many respects, Zap, the film guys sort of walked into this the right way up in the first place, because they just really just had a clean film scan and then had a conscious decision whether or not to apply any kind of lookup table as a bake-in or just as a monitor look. And that's worked out really well.
Yes, exactly. So, like I said, we should talk about the high-end, people who are really – the people who have been working with DPX files, which, are really the high-end people. They kind of – you put it very well. They have their right side up all the time and being always knowing you need a LUT to view everything, and they view everything through this LUT, and they make all the adjustments before this LUT and then view it through this view LUT and say, okay, this looks this and this looks like that, and everything is calibrated and everything is fine. So that is – basically the way to do it. But the workflow, when it starts to hopping between facilities and hopping between programs and hopping between continents and everything, it's very difficult to get a workflow that is perfect for everyone. I mean, there are issues with gamma even in something like the QuickTime viewer, which almost every day I look at some video and I view it in the QuickTime viewer. Well, it's looks wrong, because I mean, the Avatar trailer, when it came out first, when I viewed it in the QuickTime trailer, it actually looked way too bright because the gamma was wrong. Looking at the exact same trailer in something like the VLC player looked correct, and so it's very dangerous ground to tread to know exactly what you're looking at, unless you have control over every program you're using and sure what what this program is doing. So unfortunately, in this day, it's getting better. It's getting there. We're not completely perfect yet. But I think stuff like the Red is helping to raise awareness. And that's why I think it's so good that the Red camera is coming in the way it is, because it gives this concept, basically the DPX concept, which was only for the high-end guys back in the day. It's basically the same concept, but more democratized for everyone. And people say, oh, this is data, and I want to view it, so I'll have to do stuff to it. It's this thought, it's this one basically lone thought, which is kind of the important thing. And realize what comes out of the render is also data. I need to do something to it to view it, and I want to add data, not basically final pixels and final pixels.
So if you do want to find out more about this, it is worth going and checking out Stu's post over on his blog about it, because he had a very definitive, if you look at ProLost and Linear Workflow, you'll find some stuff there. Also, Stu had a very good conversation with our own John Montgomery in 2006 about this. If you look up After Effects 32-bit Workflow in depth, it was a podcast and an article where they discussed setting up AE workflows. This was for AE7. Of course, it's changed a bit since then, of course. Yep. But it's a good reference if you want to read up on that. And then now in the 3D world, have you got any sort of recommendations as to where people would be well placed to understand setting up their texture and stuff? For example, your blog.
Yes, that is one place, although I haven't specifically mentioned the gamma stuff so much on my blog yet, because I was actually planning to do a specific site on the topic, which unfortunately I never actually had time to do this specific site, so sorry guys. But there is some stuff on my blog on it, and I will probably need to do more now.
Now, there is some stuff on your site, just to be fair. There and is, you have been doing quite a lot of work in this area. You've done lectures at SIGGRAPH and Courseware, and you've also done stuff with Autodesk. And it's obviously something that that your parent company, Mental Images, is aware of, well and truly.
Yes. I've been teaching this a long time in various places. And like I said, my blog, mentalraytips.com, which is, of course, Mental Ray related, but touches on the subject. And then we have the so far ill-fated linearworkflow.com, which really doesn't tell you much yet. It does have some links to some wiki entries you can read. I was planning to make this site the beautiful definitive place, and unfortunately I haven't been able to figure out the definitive workflow yet, so that's basically the reason the site is kind of on hold, because there is no really the perfect answer isn't there, but just yet.
But you can get a 2 plus 2 doesn't equal 10 t-shirt, I think, if you go to linearworkflow.com. Zap, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
I have to say, I really enjoyed that discussion. Again, being a big fan of actually doing motion graphics design work in linear light space, makes those blooms just extra sexy and more organic, I guess you can say. And if you want to check out Master Zap's blog, you can find him at mentalraytips.blogspot.com. Again, that's mentalraytips.blogspot.com. And then Stu Mashwit's post blog, I'm sure you probably already know, but it's prolost.com, prolost.com. Again, he has a lot of really interesting articles about linear light and the benefits of compositing in linear light space. Actually, it came to mind, you know, he's kind of came up so many times in the podcast, he should actually pay him permission in the podcast. But anyway, a great blog that Stu does, and he's a good friend of all of us at Effects Guide, as is Master Zap. Well, that's it for this week. If you have any questions or comments, be sure to contact us. You can find links on the homepage. If you have any comments, you can also just go ahead and post them in the quick take section of our website and the forums. Until next week, for Jeff Huser and Mike Seymour, thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.